Historians of the Hijaz, such as Ahmed ibn Zaini Dahlan, wrote a history about the Wahhabi movement, from which I recited or just told you about the gist of the story. Until 1920s, a recrudescence occurs, and Abdulaziz ibn Saud and al-Sheikh, as they're known, the descendants of Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab, the house of the Sheikh, he's the Sheikh, Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab, prominent family name. And again, the Akhwain, as they call themselves, the brothers, short for Ikhwanu min ata'Allah, which is what they call themselves, the brothers of whoever obeys Allah, and he obeys Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab in his ijtihad, wild ijtihad, the worst of the shirk. As for everybody else, they killed them. They went to Ta'if, had a slaughter, the men of Abdulaziz, in the early 1920s, I think probably 1924. In Tanum, a little village near Ta'if, outside of Ta'if is near Mecca. The Yemeni Hajj coming from Hadramaut, Hadramautis told me about it. Over 4,000 Hajjis, Labbaik, Allahumma Labbaik, Allahumma Labbaik, Allahumma Labbaik, in Alhamda, wa Ni'amata, etc. They killed them to the man. Over 4,000 men, women, and children killed. They're Mushrikeen. 1924, this is in living memory. Nobody came back. Bakrat Abihim, the person said, they killed them to the man, the last man. Wiped out by the Wahhabis. إذا قيل لهم لا تفسدوا في الأرض قالوا إنما نحن مصلحون. And if it's said to them, don't make corruption in the land, they say, we're only reformers. So by the grace of the English, they took over the entire peninsula. And then oil was discovered. And then a big facelift happened. The literature was printed up with all the petrodollars, and the Wahhabi madhab under the Salafi, the new name of Salafism, spread across the world with petrodollars. One of the printers in the United States, who I know personally, said, yeah, this is in the 1980s. Every single branch of the Muslim student organization of each university had a worker, somebody paid by the Saudi embassy to watch. Whenever anybody gave a dars and tafsir, they were to make a rebuttal with Wahhabi ideas. They didn't call their ideas Wahhabism, they called it a dawah. And they had a whole bureau of dawah to spread their ideas. And it succeeded. Today, Salafism, or Wahhabism, whatever you care to call it, is the default Islam in many places. One of them, Egypt. Gamal Abdel Nasser cut down the trees. The ulama, Azhar was great before. He cut it down by nationalizing the Awqaf. Take away an institution's funding and presto changeo, you've got an institution that nobody's interested in sending one of their more intelligent kids to anymore, like they used to in Egypt. Took the Awqaf. Today, the Azharite, when he goes across town in a bus, he takes off his turban and he takes off his jubba and puts it aside as people look at him and sneer. Made Azhar irrelevant. And people weren't satisfied with the religion disappearing, secularism taking over in Egypt. And so what did they do? What happens when you clear-cut a forest? Get rid of all the ulama, the traditional ulama, except a handful of irrelevant ones so that nobody listens to anymore. When you clear-cut a forest, chop all the trees down, the weeds spring up. Because people don't agree that there shouldn't be any religion. So they made their own religion. What was handy? The literature from Saudi Arabia. So today, Egypt is a valid bid'ah. It's a Wahhabi valid. Nobody even knows what a madhab is. The most desperate Salafis and Wahhabis, the most crazy, the most bloodthirsty, the most sanguinary in Egypt. Afghan jihad was fought mostly by Afghanis. We can believe Jason Burke, and we can believe Ahmed Rashid and others. The Arabs that went there during the 1980s were mostly for support and mostly for funding and for refugee care and for hospitalization. They worked in Pakistan principally, but also some of them in Afghanistan. The Afghans bore the brunt of the fighting against the Soviets. At the end of the 1980s, the tenor, these were Hanafi Muslims. At the end of the 1980s, the tenor changed of the Mujahideen. And they became Wahhabiized. Jason Burke, in his book Al-Qaeda, which has a lot of things right and not very many things wrong in it, he writes, it's that when the Egyptian came to the area, this is when the things changed, the Wahhabi Islam. The jihadis became a Wahhabi-oriented Islam. Sayyaf and others came into prominence, most connected. And to tell the truth, Saudi Arabia was spending a lot of money, 50 million during the jihad itself, and many, many millions afterward. And they spent many, many hundreds of millions in education, spreading the Dawah. Jason Burke, in his book, he doesn't have a thesis, he doesn't have any idea exactly why it was that the Wahhabis from Egypt, or he says, why are they so sanguinary? One of the people who wrote a book about his experience in Afghanistan in the 1980s, the early 1980s, he says, yeah, he says, I saw the Afghans were the most polite people and were the best people and the kindest to their guests. They were the best people you could possibly imagine. I wasn't afraid for my life except once in the whole time that I was there. He says, when I met an Egyptian who was ready to kill him, because he was a non-Muslim. So the most extreme and the least connected with previous generations of is traditional Islam. Traditional Islam meaning people who had studied Islam, with people who had studied Islam, with people who had studied Islam back to the Prophet, and so that the hal of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam was found in them. How did Islam enter Afghanistan in the first place? The Sahaba went out from Medina and went out from Mecca and they never came back. The Ruh of the Rasul sallallahu alayhi wa sallam convinced them. And they didn't hand out pamphlets. And they didn't have philosophical discourses. But rather people saw them pray. And they didn't have massive armies to force everybody. The center of Central Asian Buddhism was Afghanistan. How did it all become Muslim in just a few years? People looked at these people coming from Medina and from Mecca who had met the Prophet ﷺ, and people who had met these people who met the Prophet ﷺ. And they saw Nur. They saw people who could solve, who wherever they went were part of the solution and not part of the problem. They saw something better than what they had, and so they entered their religion. And so when you divorce this, when you cut it off, when there's a little sect who says, no, everyone in the Ummah is a kafir except the one that agrees with my Shaykh's ijtihad. In other words, Wahhabi Islam, you have a big discontinuity. And all of the tradition that they've thrown out and rejected, all of the principles, what did they make up for it with? With their own ijtihad. And so this is what the Wahhabis didn't see anybody in the Pakistan and India that resembled Wahhabis exactly, more than the Deobandis, because they were agreed with them on the question of Tawassul. Not on the question of its being shirk or kufr, but on the question that one should not do it. And so they funded the 4,000 Deobandi madrasas appeared in Pakistan and India during this time. And from this were the most of the people that were recruited. And I submit that there's a crisis there. The crisis is could Ephraim and Zechariah, or could Phabim and Desah. He has truly succeeded who purifies it, purifies the nets. And he is truly wretched and disappointed who tramples it underfoot, right? Lets the nets ride on top of him like a donkey. So this is the current state. Well, why are they mad against us? Security analysts, like the one that wrote Imperial Hubris, the current party line on the part of certain corporate Texan politicians, talking to the fundamentalist constituency, is that they hate us because we're for democracy. They hate us because we have freedom and liberties. That's why the Muslims hate us. Well, if we can believe the man who signed his name Anonymous in his book Imperial Hubris, a book that I recommend for everyone who wants to understand anything about the current situation. This is a man who is a CIA officer in charge of the desk that was responsible for bin Laden and the Wahhabi Jihadi front that they're currently, the security forces are currently battling it out with. He says, no, they don't hate us because we're liberal. He says, they don't hate us because of homosexual marriages. They don't hate us because we have this and we have that and we have democratic institutions. He says, they're not comfortable with any of this. They're not comfortable with our bars and so forth. True. He says, but this doesn't make any of them fighting mad. He says, what they're upset about are six things. And they're not cultural institutions. He says, they're policies. Policies by the United States. And his whole point in writing this book is he says, well, guys, why don't we change our policies? Why don't we pull the rug out from under these crazed, hairy-eyed jihadis so they don't have a platform to speak to the Muslims anymore and recruit anymore from? Because these policies are basically six in number. He says, the fact that America aids and abets, or the West aids and abets China and India and Russia in oppressing their Muslim minorities with everything that is in their power, helping them, persecuting the Muslims there. Said they aid and abet Israel in their persecution and in their 35-year-long occupation of the land of the Palestinians, the West Bank. Never saying no to anything, only saying yes. How much do you want? We'll pay it. We'll cover the tab. Since they're mad about the invasion of Afghanistan and the invasion of Iraq, they're mad about Western troops in Saudi Arabia, in Qatar, in Kuwait, in the Muslim heartlands, from which they launch military operations that shoot bullets through Muslims and drop explosives on Muslims. So they're mad about artificially depressed oil prices that don't reflect the market value. The Muslims are pumping out their resources as fast as they possibly can, or else, so that the Americans can, 10% of the world's people can consume 40% of the world's petrol at far below market price. And they're mad about Kafir governments in the Muslim countries. This is a specifically Wahhabi and the takfir of the Muslim governments. The Muslim position is that nobody becomes a non-Muslim through committing a sin, even if it's a grievous sin, as long as they believe La ilaha illallah Muhammad Rasulullah. So he said, these are the issues. He says, as a result, bin Laden and the bin Ladens, the others like him, because his ideas are spreading through the internet. You don't have to go to Sudan to learn how to make a bomb anymore. You can learn it off the internet. And you can get these ideas of Islam. So be a jihadi. Be a suicide bomber. It's spreading because of these grievances. So pull the rug out from under them. Change the policies. Get the ship of state going in a different direction. And so, on this basis, he sounds like he talks what he sounds like he knows what he's talking about from where I sit. And on this basis, the Wahhabis have issued the jihads with their own understanding of jihad, not with the traditional ulama understanding of jihad, or the sahih understanding of jihad.